today I want to discuss, I guess, two more mitzvot in the order of mitzvot that we've been doing. Next week we'll talk about Shavuos. That'll be next week's class, and that'll be the final one of the season. So there's two mitzvot I want to discuss this week. Both of them, I think, lesser known, maybe a little more abstract or more obscure, but we'll try to understand what they mean and draw out the lessons from them. So the first mitzvah, this is in the book of Devarim, chapter 6, verse 16. It says, "Do not test Hashem your God as you tested him at Massa." So Massa was the place back when the Jews first left Egypt. And they were traveling, and you know they complained they wanted water, things were difficult. So the Jews tested God. They said, "Is God with us or not? You know, God took us out of Egypt, where is he gone? Is he still taking care of us or not?" And they tested God. So the Torah gives a prohibition, one's not supposed to test God. Don't test God. So the question is, what exactly does it mean to test God? What is the Torah prohibiting and why? It doesn't just mean questioning God's involvement. I mean, for the Jews in the desert, it was clear that God was involved. I mean, they just left Egypt, saw 10 plagues, they saw the splitting of the sea. It's not questioning his existence, because again, the Jews definitely saw his existence. It's mainly quoted for two different applications. Number one being that we shouldn't hinge our service upon God rewarding us. So for instance, I'll say, "God, here's the deal, right? If you get me a six-digit salary job starting in 2 weeks, I'll be sure to keep kosher, right? But if not, forget about it." I mean, if we make our service of God hinged upon God's rewarding us, that's the problem. That's testing God for the reward. Ramban, Nachmanides writes, "To say that I only serve God if he does miracles for me, or if I succeed in life in the areas which I wish to succeed, that is testing God." And the message being, our service of God is not based on what God does for us. That's not why we serve God. It says explicitly in Pirkei Avos, it says, "Don't be a servant who serves in order to receive reward. Be a servant who serves not in order to receive reward." We don't serve God for reward. We believe that we serve God because it's correct, it's true, it's right. God's the source of our existence, and therefore we're indebted to God. He doesn't owe us, we owe him, as it were. So we serve God. So God does reward, and that's one of the tenets of Judaism, that God does give us reward for our actions. And to the extent that the rabbis teach us that God does not cut off the reward of any creature in this world. Every good action, even by the biggest, the most wicked person out there, will still get rewarded. So even if a terrible person did a good action, he gets his reward one way or the other. God rewards. That we know. But that can't be the basis of our service of God. And to take it to the extent to test God, say, "God, I'm not going to do what you ask of me unless you reward me," that's prohibited by the Torah. The analogy I would give, we can't treat God like a vending machine. You know, I put in my quarter and I take out my chocolate. That's not how God works. So I'll say, "Okay, God, I'll put in a mitzvah and then you'll give me back my goodies." We don't serve God in that manner. Nachmanides continues, and he says another important point. Nachmanides says that God doesn't desire to perform miracles for every single individual in every single generation, every single moment of life. I mean, we could demand miracles from God. "God, I'm not going to do this unless you give me a miracle." But that's not how God runs the world. God does not run the world and performs miracles every single day. Why is that? So on the one hand, it becomes very shallow. You know, it's a game, basically. Okay, it's a tit for a tat, that type of thing. And we don't believe in that. The ancient idolaters, the pagans, that was essentially their system. You know, you go to the rain god, "I need rain." Okay, you do a little dance, and down comes the rain. And you go to the sun god, "You need sun," so you offer a sacrifice, and out comes the sun. And that was the way that they served their gods. There wasn't any feeling that I'm indebted to the god. It was more, "This god is going to do things for me. This god's at my disposal." And that's how the pagans worship their gods. When we worship God, the one and only, we say that's not how it works. We serve God because he is the creator of all. We don't play games with God. We don't test him. We don't play games with him. So that's one point. If God did miracles constantly, it would also impact our free choice. We'll talk more about free choice later on today, I hope. But one of the fundamentals of Judaism is free choice. That we choose right from wrong. And that we have a challenge in front of us. If God was constantly performing miracles every single moment, so then we lose our ability to really choose right and wrong, because God's just queer in front of our faces. We would all love it, you know, if God would just, you know, reveal himself to us. "Here I am, this is my plan for you in life, this is what you should do." But if that happened, then we wouldn't have any challenge. There would be no decisions to make. We would know exactly what to do in life. And God's here to give us a challenge. Good question?
Yeah, but don't we hold that the existence of the world is a constant, ongoing miracle?
But we don't perceive it that way.
I do.
Okay, well, we should. We should perceive it that way, but most people do not.
Those of us who have been involved in trying to make things work are amazed at anything.
Yes. I mean, nature is simply a constant, ongoing miracle. That's clear. But on the other hand, many, many scientists say, I don't need to talk about God. I can explain it all based on natural occurrences. And so we say, where did all those rules come from? Who created all that complexity and that intelligence in the world? We say it's obviously a very intelligent and powerful God. But the miracles we're talking about are the ones which are supernatural, out of the ordinary, things which would you know, shock you into seeing there's a God. But God doesn't want to perform miracles all the time. So we say, God, I need a miracle. Here, I'll do this mitzvah, give me a miracle. God says, that's not how I work, because I want to make sure the human being has free choice. And if a human being was able to test me and demand miracles, so then God's presence would be clear and obvious, and therefore there'd be no challenge in life. Because if we know God is there watching us every single moment, we're never going to make a bad decision. We're never going to be dishonest. We're never going to be unethical. We're never going to do something to hurt somebody else, because we know that we're being watched by God. Now, our goal is to develop that feeling without the miracles. The goal of every single Jew is that we should develop that sense of God's presence in life from our own development. I mean, God doesn't display himself to us openly, but God says, I want you to work on your understanding of me through the Torah, through the world, through thought, through careful observance. And at that point, you perceive that I'm here in life, not because I did a miracle for you. And then you have then you make the right choices. But not because I'm hammering it upon your head with miracles, rather because you come to it on your own. So testing God would be a way to demand miracles, and God says that's just not how the world's supposed to work, because then that's not, the human being loses their challenge in life. Because if they saw a miracle every single moment, at that point, there's no decisions to make. Everything will be easy. There's a third point here as well. If you're testing God to figure out, is he involved, is he present or not? So at that point, we're going to cast aside tradition, cast aside the lessons that have been taught from parent to child and teacher to student for the past 3,000 years, and just say, okay, God, show me or don't show me. And the Torah is very, very much based upon tradition, that we believe there's a Masorah, there's a transmission that came from Mount Sinai to this very day, from parent to child, teacher to student. Which is why anybody who's Jewish is sitting here today, because somebody in every generation in the past 3,000 years has passed on that tradition, you know, to your ancestors. And then at this point, we're here because of our ancestors. That's why we're here. If the existence and involvement of a God was based upon miracles happening day in and day out, so at that point, having it as a tradition is no longer meaningful. Because forget the tradition, I need to see a miracle right now. And God says, no, I want you to understand me through tradition. We have to look at the Jewish people as a long link. Kabbalistic thinkers look at it as like there's one human being, as it were, called the Jewish people. And it kind of like spreads down through generations, from the head down to the toes, generation to generation. And we're all one massive body. And it's because we link together in terms of this idea of the transmission, of the Masorah. There's this tradition passed from parent to child and teacher to student, which links us all together as one. If each individual just said, okay, I'm going to discover God on my own, where's the miracle? So we're not associating with the history of our people, with our ancestors. We're just kind of, you know, each as individuals coming to it based on what we see in front of our eyes. And God wants Judaism to be set up as a chain of transmission, not just as individuals deciding on their own every generation, what should I do? So that's another point. It says in the Torah, it says that you should look towards your elders and they'll teach you. We know the whole idea of the Pesach Seder is based on the Torah saying, when your children ask you these questions, teach them. And the idea is that we're supposed to be passing on generation to generation all the ideals of Judaism. So there's three different thoughts as to why God doesn't want us to play with miracles in that way, to test him. We want to make sure that it doesn't become a shallow game. We want to make sure that we understand our debt towards God. We want to make sure that we have free choice. We don't see miracles constantly. We also want to be sure that there is an idea and semblance of a tradition, of a Masorah, of a transmission generation to generation, because that really is the foundation of Judaism. So three different ideas over here. And the bottom line is that we serve God regardless, meaning that testing God means that I trust that God is with me. So, not testing God, but if I don't test God, that means I'm trusting God is with me at all moments, whether I see him or not. And that's really what we're trying to get at. That we understand that we don't see God all the time, we don't perceive God, we don't always see miracles, but we know that He's always running the show behind the scenes. If we say, okay, God, I'm not going to do anything until I see an open miracle, then we're denying the fact that God's around when we don't see Him. And the bottom line is we have to see God at all times. Our role is to understand that God runs the world, whether He's splitting the Red Sea, or whether we had a normal day here in the month of, what's today, May or June? It's still May. It's still May today, right? May in Maryland. God's still running the world regardless. If the understanding of God is based on demanding miracles, so then that means we're denying God, we don't see a miracle. And that goes against everything we believe about God. We serve God regardless, and know whatever is happening out there is God and is good for us, no matter what. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that the reward we get for doing mitzvos ultimately is in the next world. We don't believe that God really rewards in this world. No, God helps us in this world. God brings us to where we need to go in this world, but the ultimate reward for doing what's right is in the next world, in the world to come. So if somebody is demanding reward in this world, they're going against the system. The system is, God says, okay, you're going to do good things. And I promise you there is going to be incredible eternal reward in the world to come. If you're requesting, well, God reward me now, so that's not how God runs the world either. Then we're saying that I'd rather have my reward in this world than the next world, and that's not what we want. Deep down, we know the reward, which is eternal and spiritual, is much greater and much more significant than the reward we can have in this world, no matter what it is. So testing God to say, give me a reward right now for the actions I'm doing, is denying the fact that there's a reward in the world to come. You're trying to kind of jump the gun and get your reward over here. So these are all different areas of why not to test God. And bottom line is, when we serve God, we do it because we love God, we do it because we fear God, we do it because we are indebted to God. And that's it. The reward will come, the reward is there, God does care, God watches, God runs the world, and He will give us reward. But it's not our role and our place to only serve for that reward, demand that reward. And that's really the crux of this mitzvah. Now there's one exception to this rule, which is very interesting. There's an exception, there is one area of life you're allowed to test God in. And this is actually explicitly discussed in the Talmud. I'll read you the passage over here. It says that, Rabbi Yochanan says, what does it mean in the Torah? The Torah says you should take tithes. Aser ta'aser. Take your tithes. And that's referring to tithing produce. You know, there was a mitzvah, still exists in the land of Israel. We would tithe produce. We would give some out to the Levites. Some would be reserved for the poor. Some would go to eat in Jerusalem. And different tithes we would give. And it says that, why does it say aser ta'aser? You should tithe your fruits. And the Rav Yochanan here is actually focusing on the fact that it's the double wording in the Torah. It doesn't just say tithe, it says aser ta'aser. Tithe, tithe, if you were to translate literally. In the art school translations of the Torah, when you have a double language, usually it says, you shall surely tithe, right? If that's how we would translate it. But why is it a double language being used? You should tithe your fruits. So Rav Yochanan writes for us, it's teaching us a lesson. Aser, you shall tithe, bishvil shetis asher, so that you will become rich. Meaning that the Torah is teaching us that taking proper tithes, giving away our produce to where it's supposed to go, that will actually bring us wealth. So we think giving away produce will actually detract from our money. Rav Yochanan guarantees to us that no, if you give away your produce properly to those who need it, it's based on the halachas in the Torah, at that point you will actually become wealthy. So the story continues. Rav Yochanan one day found a child. And he said to the child, what verse did you learn today in school? Now, of course, the kids were learning Torah in school. What verse did you learn in school today? So the kid said, the same verse we're talking about, aser ta'aser, to tithe your produce. So he said to the kid, well, what does that mean? And the kid said, well, we should tithe in order so that you can become rich. So tithing makes you rich. So then Rav Yochanan asked him, how do you know that? He said, well, why don't you go try it out and see if it works? And then he said, well, are you allowed to test God that way? Like, I'm going to test God. Okay, God, here we go. I'm going to take my tithes. Make me rich now. Let me see all the money. And he said, yeah, you are allowed to. Right? So he first said you can't do it based on what we discussed. And he says you're allowed to. Because why? Rabbi Hoshaya said this is the exception to the rule. The exception to the rule testing God is found in taking proper tithes, and he quotes from a verse in the book of Malachi. And it says in the verse in Malachi, it says, they should bring all of their tithes to the storehouse, and there shall be food in our homes. And God says, you can test me on this one. And I will open up for you the warehouses of the heavens, and I will empty them out to you until you don't, you know, until you have, you know, way more than enough. That's what God says. So there's a verse in the prophets which teaches us that when it comes to tithing, you're allowed to test God. And God says, test me on this one, and you'll see. So there's a dispute. Does this apply only to tithing of produce, as is the specific translation of that verse, or does it also apply to tzedakah money? There are authorities that say this applies to tzedakah as well, that if you separate tzedakah, you can expect, you can test God and say, God, I'm expecting a reward for this one. You're allowed to do it. Now, I would suggest that it has to be commensurate. So I say, okay, God, I'm giving a nickel tzedakah. I want a new sports car, right? So, like, I don't know if that's going to work. But if you say, God, you know, I'm giving reasonable tzedakah for my income, and, you know, it says in the Talmud, I can request back that I should succeed financially, you know, based on my own level. So that seems like that's appropriate, that's allowed to do. So even though we said in the entire, and when it comes to any other mitzvah, you're not allowed to test God on. You can't say, God, I'm only going to, you know, keep kosher if you, you know, give me a good job. You can't say that. But you could say, God, I'm giving tzedakah, I mean, at least I'm giving my tithes, and I'm expecting to get back reward for that. It certainly applies to actual tithes of produce in Israel, and possibly applies to tzedakah money. But that's one area we have this exception. Very interesting thing. So that's one that's one understanding of this mitzvah. There's a second point which is made, that this mitzvah, not only is it saying not to test God in terms of reward, but also it's quoted not to excessively interrogate a prophet. We know that one of the we don't have prophets anymore. And that's quoted in the Talmud. The prophecy stopped around the period of the Second Temple. But in the times of prophets, prophets are a major part of life. And we don't, it's something so foreign to us, we don't realize this. But prophets, we're aware of, there's 48 prophets which are mentioned in the Tanakh. 48 males and 7 females are prophets in Tanakh. So 55. But in the Talmud tells us there are actually, you know, hundreds of thousands of prophets, seemingly. Over 100,000 at least, prophets which existed during those times. The ones we have discussed in the Tanakh are the ones that actually had messages that lasted for all eternity, for the future. So there may have been other prophets walking around with prophecies that are relevant to their time in history. Those are not written down, recorded for us. The ones that are recorded are ones relevant to us as well. But prophecy was a major part of life. And prophets would come and tell you all sorts of things. They could tell you about the future. They could tell you about, you know, enemy armies coming to attack. They could tell you about your own purpose in life. Of course, you know, some authorities describe that prophets are able to see into a person and tell you, like, why did God create you? What are you good at? What are you here for on this planet? What's your goal in life? And it's an amazing thing. But the question is, you know, how do you become verified as a prophet? What makes you a prophet? If I walk in and tell everybody, say, okay, I had prophecy from God, like, why should you trust me? So there was a series of tests that were done in order to authenticate a prophet. And it's a very important thing to understand that, you know, many religions have their prophets, but our prophecy is really based on, we'll call it 2 points, why we trust our prophets. Number one, which is the most important point, is that we actually don't really trust any prophets directly. And what I mean by that is the following. The only prophet that we trust directly was Moses. We trust him directly. Why? Because the Torah records that the entire people actually witnessed God speaking to Moses. So we saw that with our own eyes. Now, the entire people saw that God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, and therefore we know Moses is a prophet. That's 100% clear to every single Jew who is standing there. The Jews did not see God speak to the other prophets necessarily. The other prophets appeared one day and said, here I am, I'm a prophet, this is what God said. You know, so said Hashem. So why do I trust them? So Maimonides writes, really based on the Talmud, and Rambam, he writes that we only trust other prophets because Moshe told us that we could trust other prophets. I mean, we know Moshe was valid because we saw God speak to Moshe. And in the Torah, it says that other prophets will come. You should listen to what the prophets say. So I'm not listening to, you know, Isaiah or Jeremiah or the other prophets because I think he's a prophet. That's not. I'm listening because Moses said listen to him. That's number one. Or else, like, why should I listen? just because you came and said I should do this or do that or act this way, act that way, why should I listen to you? Because the answer is because in the Torah, we know Moshe was valid, and God said to Moshe that he should tell the people when other prophets arise in the future, you should listen to the words of those prophets. That's the first very important point. But when a prophet arrived on the scene, like, how do you know he's a prophet? Maybe he's a fraud. I mean, what's the difference between a prophet and a fraud? And that's really the question. So there was actually a process of to authenticate the prophet, to verify. And this I'll read to you again from the Rambam, Maimonides. This is chapter 10 of the laws of what he calls the Sodia Torah, the fundamentals of Torah. And he says that any prophet that arises and claims he was sent by God, he doesn't need to make a miracle like Moshe, or like Eliyahu, like Elijah. He doesn't need to make miracles. What does he have to do? He has to tell us the future, and what he predicts has to actually come true. That's what he has to do. So when a person comes, and number one, he has to be a person that you feel is actually worthy of being a prophet. I mean, if he's some lowlife, you know, thief, you know, adulterer or something, then you can disregard him on the spot. Has to be somebody that we see as somebody who's a servant of God, who's an upright individual, honest, respected, his proper mito, his proper character. He's not coming to tamper with the Torah itself. A prophet has no right to add or subtract from the Torah. Rather, he serves God according to the Torah. And then we don't make him go and split the sea or revive the dead. Rather, we ask him, okay, predict for us the future. And if he can do this several times, the Rambam says. You know, he says, you can check him a lot of times. He can do this several times. And if all the times he predicts the future comes true, at that point you say, this is a valid prophet. And now Moshe commands me, if I have verified this guy to be a prophet, I should listen to what he says. And then that's how we check out prophets. Now the way that this comes into our discussion is the following. The Rambam writes, he says that somebody's been verified as a prophet. At that point, you're allowed to regard him as a prophet, and you should no longer excessively interrogate him anymore. Once he's passed the test, and he's labeled Navi, he's now a prophet. At that point, you trust him, you don't test him anymore. If you do test him further, you actually violated this prohibition in the Torah not to test God. Because testing God's prophet is tantamount to testing God in this context. So that's what it means. And the reason for this is the following. You can't picture a prophet as somebody that's a miracle worker. You know, that's not who he is. He's somebody who is very, very elevated, very refined, very spiritual, who has this way to be in touch with God. That's what a prophet is. He's not plugged in 24/7. So you can't just stay on the spot, predict what's going to happen there, tell me what's going to happen there, do this miracle. That's not who a prophet is. But that's not what God means for prophets to be. That's not what prophecy is according to the Torah. So if you think you can demand from this prophet anything you want, any time of day, any day of the week, you're going to be let down. Because that's not what prophecy is according to the Torah. And then at that point, if you keep on doing it and he can't carry through with his promises, you're going to no longer have respect for the prophet. And then when he does have a message from God, you're not going to respect that message. So the Torah says once he has to go through the interrogation process, you got to test him out and test him out well. But once he's been tested and authenticated, at that point, stop testing him. Trust that he is a valid prophet, just as Moshe told us would be. And then listen to him. And that's what the Rambam writes. So the other half of this mitzvah we've discussed is not just the idea of not testing God, it's not to test God's prophets. We don't want to lose respect for somebody who's here to bring us God's message. So that is the mitzvah of not testing God. Any questions on this? We move to another one. Any questions on this one? Okay.